Blog Talk Radio.
Green Talk Live and more. With the shots, this is Green Talk Live, you are now in tune. You ain't locked in yet, then you will be soon. Put your thinking caps on, this is intellectual. Moses and Rivera go deep in the thick of vegetables. It's the shots, the form of the speakers who want to crush. Knowledge is power, meaningful topics, getting the trust. Nobody brings it like the shots, throw the towel out. Here's the number for your phone so you can dial out. 347-838-9540. Don't call too late, cause you don't want to miss all the action. Speaking with passion, pick up for the show like Bill Paxton. Expand your horizons, open your mind. Had a hard, long day, come and have a good time. Have an opinion to share? Call in and let it go. Welcome on, it's Real Talk Radio.
It's Green Talk Live and more.
When it's Real Talk Radio with the chefs.
I'm Chef Moses.
And I'm Chef Rivera. Thank you for a 12 show. 12 show.
Chef is having a birthday cake right now. Tonight.
We're going to be talking about New York City Gardens and its fruition. The New York City Garden Movement has been around since roughly like the 50s. And the evolution took place on different levels. And the level that we are in right now, it's an amazing level. And possibly laws will be passed that will help community gardens overall across the city. Today's guest is from the New York City Garden Coalition. His name is Aziza Dekan. Aziza? Hello?
Hello, I'm here.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good.
He's one of the members of the board of the coalition, an amazing coalition with a rich history in the green movement and in the garden movement.
In New York City.
In New York City.
And abroad.
And abroad. And they're the group to go to when you need some help. These guys are amazing. They put their necks on the line every single day for what they believe in as far as local micro food systems is concerned. And it's a pleasure to have you on, Aziza.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So real quick, Aziz, if you could give us a brief history about yourself and what you do, I'm pretty sure a lot of our guests would like to know about that.
The New York City Community, I'm actually the executive director of the New York City Community Garden Coalition, and mm-hmm. we were founded in 1996. And basically, our mission is to promote, preserve, and community gardens throughout the New York City five boroughs. And we do that through education, through advocacy, through grassroots activism. And we started in 1996 when Mayor Giuliani was around, and he and other developers were beginning to destroy open spaces. Building apartments, office buildings, and doing it pretty much ruthlessly, I think is probably the best way to say it, where they would come in with bulldozers and just level gardens. And really what it did was it destroyed communities, much of the same way that the highways that were being built in the 50s split communities. That's what destroying the community gardens did. Many of the gardens are in low-income communities, and especially people of color, immigrants, and those are the people that really treasure these open spaces. They can grow the crops that are indigenous to their homeland, crops mm-hmm. that food and their food sources. So that's how we started, and we continue to work to preserve community gardens throughout the five boroughs.
So, Aziz, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So, I often like to tell people I was a very wild kid, and I ended up in boarding school in New Jersey for 4 years during high school, which was probably a really good thing for me. It calmed me down a little and gave me some focus. And I think, for all the people out there who are listening, mentoring and being with kids who are troubled, myself being one of those kids, really helps. It really gives young folk a direction. So when I was in high school, I got that direction, and I ended up going to Rutgers and graduating from the Rutgers Ag School with a degree in biological sciences. And in 1978, I started one of the first organic farms in New Jersey, and did that for a number of years. Changed course after a while. I sold the property, and went into the environmental business. And after that, I got very involved in my community in New Jersey, in both the land use programs. I was on my local planning board for 13 years, and then I was on a number of different nonprofit boards, and that's where I got my love for working with nonprofits. And in 2000, I just changed careers again and became a professional fundraiser for mostly for social justice organizations, Coalition for the Homeless in New York, Fortune Society, which works with the formerly incarcerated. And it's this working. Now I have my own consulting business. I work with nonprofits to help them raise money for organizing, and that's what I'm doing for the New York City Community Garden Coalition.
Excellent. That's a long journey over there, man.
Well, you know what it is? I believe that you have to give back, and I believe that,
true,
you know, social justice, you know, we talk a lot about it. We talk often about how we can help people who, you know, who need help. And then you start looking at what the government isn't doing for folks. And you realize that you have to be out on the streets and agitating and doing whatever's needed to help those who need help. And, you know, the whole argument about takers and makers is just a smokescreen, really. I mean, nobody wants to be a taker, as the other side calls it. You know, everybody wants a decent wage. Everybody wants to have some dignity, and so that's what I try to do. And just in the same thing, I think the community gardens are all a part of that. It's a part about building community. It's a part about,
yep,
you know, I told you about mentoring. It's about mentoring kids, teaching kids to respect the land, teaching kids to respect open space. And it's really important. And older people have so much to give. And so community gardens are a huge part of that, I believe.
Wow.
You know, I think what you're saying is that you're absolutely right. And, you know what, I'm going to say this. I think that it's, you know, people like yourself and a whole lot of other people that have took it upon themselves to try to do something for their community. Their community would be wherever they're at, and sometimes it's not necessarily wherever they're at. I'm seeing a lot of change in the gardening, farming, and the urban ag scene. I wanted to see if you could, like, expound a little bit and tell us on, you know, maybe some of the new trends or some of the new legislation or laws that are being addressed as far as advocacy is concerned.
So we're currently working with a Bloomberg initiative that worked towards preserving some community gardens. And the legislation at that time and that is currently in effect really doesn't protect everybody. It's pretty selective. And, you know, we've seen Coney Island, for instance, Boardwalk Community Garden in Coney Island, being taken away, you know, at dawn on December 28th of last year. And bulldozed into the ground so that they could put an amphitheater in, you know, and the community, and the community expressed their opinion that they didn't want it. They told their local community board they didn't want it, and the local community board that voted, you know, 10-0 to stop the project. But, you know, there's $53 million behind this project, and a lot of big players, both politicians and developers, and so we're in court now fighting that and trying to stop and and to restore the community garden that survived Hurricane Dean years. So that's part of what we do, but, you know, you asked a great question, so what's changing? And we're working with the new speaker, Melissa Viterra-Marx, who's trying to really, I believe she's a really good person on this. She's been on the right side of so many issues. She's up from up at Harlem, where there are, you know, a lot of community guards. And we just met with her. The organization just met with her. And she's expressed interest in working with us. And we hope that after all the budget work is done in June, the end of June, that we'll convene with her, convene with who we believe is a very progressive mayor. De Blasio should be able to help us. And, you know, if with the right push, with enough people behind us, because we certainly can't do this alone, we feel that we can make a permanent agreement that really does work and save all community gardens in the city.
Excellent. Aziza, correct me if I'm wrong, that particular garden, I'm just seeing, you know, I'm just testing my trivia. That particular garden you're talking about in Brooklyn, is that the one on Surf Avenue?
Oh, it is. Yep. It's right between Surf Avenue and the boardwalk itself.
Right. Actually, me and Chef was up there about a month ago.
Yeah.
And speaking to some of the people up there, though, it was really, that garden has been there for a long time, and it's a lot of people.
A lot of history.
A lot of history, but they also are feeding a lot of people out of that garden.
That garden, yeah.
Right.
So that's something that's definitely needed. A green oasis that actually is an oasis, green space.
That remains an oasis.
And actually is doing something for the community as opposed to bureaucracy. So,
you know, and to that, Chef, here's what I believe in this, that community garden is a perfect example of what you're talking about, you know, new trends of making, you know, of growing food and having farmers markets. But more to the point is, in these low-income communities, my board member, Karen Washington, who's a founder of the New York City Community Garden Coalition, once said...
That's my girl. Shout out. Big up to Karen.
I mean, she said it best. You know, we talk about food deserts and, you know, the lack of fresh produce in these communities. But she said it best. It's not a food desert. It's food apartheid. And, you know, if you can come down to that and really grasp what that means, it's all the more reason why you can be astounded of what these gardens can produce. And you hit it right on the nose. These gardens provide food and fresh food for people who normally can't get it. It's not in their, you know, it's not in their neighborhood. So it serves a real vital purpose.
Aziza, now I want to throw you a real bully question right here. Let me ask you a question. Realistically, I have to ask you this. Are organic farmers, are we a threat to Monsanto and people of that caliber?
In the status quo altogether.
You know, I thought you were going to ask me a tough question. Yes, we are a threat to them.
I'm so bad. No, we stop. But no, I mean, let me say it like this.
Yeah.
The question still stands, but I don't want to clean it up. I shouldn't ask you, but I want to ask you, as far as that, let me add this. What is the trend do you forecast for organic against GMOs?
GMOs, yeah, in New York City.
Yeah. You know, that's the crux of the issue, isn't it, guys? I mean, you just don't know. We know what the power is of Monsanto. I mean, you can see the bills that are being written and how they get excluded from lawsuits. And, you know, if there's seed, if you have a farm next to a Monsanto seed farm and their seed pollinates yours, they'll sue you for infringement of trademark. I mean, you know, really? This is where we're at now, and, you know, where does our Where do the hybrid seeds, what happens to them? And yeah, it's an amazing question to ask. And I think we are a threat to them because of the laws they're trying to write. You know, the people who write those kind of really tight laws, they're afraid of something. And I'll just go back a second. You know, in the Boardwalk Garden, when you go up against power, you start seeing when they're scared, when they start doing strange stuff. And and what they did at Boardwalk Garden was they bulldozed it at 5 in the morning. And my question to them has always been, if you're so proud of your project, and again, I'll say it to Monsanto, if you're so proud of your product, then why would you do it in the middle of the night when nobody sees it? In Boardwalk Garden, why didn't the developer and the borough president come out and do a big ribbon-cutting ceremony and celebrate this new thing? Why doesn't Monsanto come out and celebrate all their seeds? Because they're afraid of us, the people, and that's where our power comes. If we find that power and stick together, we can beat a lot of these things.
You see what you just said, Aziza? That's the key. If we have the power, but the concept, we don't stick together. We all have to stick together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this is what I have been, this is what me and Chef, you know, a part of our advocacy to a large degree, is to, in fact, include as many people
as possible
and, you know, all different nationalities. Because then there's a consensus that...
And there's a platform.
And a platform that people are starting to see, well, wait a minute, it's not just one set of people. It's a whole bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I think that... I was being facetious, but I think that we're about to... encroach on some toes with this organic
versus
GMOs.
And I know, you know, I was kidding you about the softball question, but because I think those of us who know what's going on out there and who like you too work in the community to make the community better, we all know that our power is being together, and we can't let the bigger powers, you know, the people, and bigger, but the ones that have more money, we can't let them scare us, I mean, or divide us. And both have really, in your community, you've shown that. You've shown how it's possible to overcome adversity and how to make your community better. And I've always been really quite amazed at your perseverance on that and how far you guys have come and helped so many people in your own community. It's a real testament to what can be done.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
There were so many people before us without question
that we won't
forget. That we won't forget and that we don't forget, you know, such as yourself, Karen Washington, Bob Lewis, Christina Grace, I mean, John Amorosa, the list goes on. Many people that are sticking and fighting with this good food revolution.
Right.
And the thing is that it's people like you that come on to our show. It's friends like yourself that come on to our show.
Right.
And some of our people get the logistics that live in our community. If they don't get it now, they'll download the show. But the overall thing is to get the information out there and to have people that have knowledge of these events and situations that are going on, so that people are more informed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like I said, it's people like us all to a large degree that contribute to this good food revolution. And I'm really hoping that more people would get excited about this, and I'm hoping that, well, you know, even if it gets to the point where the famine starts, my whole thing is, well, at least something made you get up to, you know, to grow something or to do something. So, you know, we applaud you, Aziza, and all of the things that you've been doing, because you have been with the coalition for a long, you know, for a minute, and you've been doing what you've been doing. So it's unsung heroes like yourself that you know, you work hard. And the thing
it pays off.
It pays off.
Well, yeah, thank you. You're very kind about that. I appreciate those words. You know, I was just reading about Cesar Chavez And when Cesar Chavez first started in California, he made it a point to tell everybody how hard and long hours he was working. And he did it because he wanted to shame people to come to the event. and by doing that, he built a movement, you know, and,
right.
and he really engaged people. And I guess, you know, you're right. We have all these people who have been there and who are working, have done it and are working shoulder to shoulder with us. And then we hope that there'll be more people coming on into the pipeline and working, you know, and continuing the fight, because that's what it is. It's the good fight. You know, I've always been told you can't fight every battle, you can't win everyone, but you can fight the good fight.
Mm-hmm.
The
good food fight. I like that.
Yeah,
like
good
that.
Food fight. I love it. We have a slogan, Jeff. We better trademark that one right away.
Hey, I already did. No, I'm just joking. But you know, like I said, it's so. I'm starting to see. You know what I'm starting to see as usual. I'm starting to see a lot more people come out. More people are interested
mm-hmm.
in growing their own food.
Mm-hmm.
But this is why they're interested. It's all right, though. They're interested now because
it's
cost effective, but the fruits and vegetables that are in the store now, they're definitely GMOs, but they are just too expensive. And a lot
yeah.
of, no, not just now, but I think this year is getting a little bit, you know, every year it gets a little bit more, but this year I've had people that has been dealing with us for years, for years, for years, for years, never asked us nothing. But now, this year, a lot of those same people that don't ask questions, they want to learn how to farm and they want to learn how to garden first. But their aspirations is farming. So I mean, there's something going on
yeah.
in the pipeline that's making people,
it's stimulating.
That's
it's
stimulating.
Beautiful.
Yeah, yeah, it's stimulating curiosity, conversation.
Yeah. yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So and. And you know what's funny, not even funny, but what's good, is that it's stimulating conversation amongst people that you wouldn't think would be stimulated amongst this type of conversation. So,
really true. Yeah. It's
yeah,
really
but you
true.
Know,
you know,
I know you know that. But
in 1978, when I had my organic farm, people didn't know what organic meant, really. You know, the idea was very novel, and now it's not. And now, like you said, you start seeing prices going up, and you have to pay real close attention, I think, to this, that climate change is going to have a big effect on large farms. You can see what happened in California with the worst drought in nearly 100 years. The price of produce from California is going to skyrocket this summer, I think. And,
yes.
you know, that's going to feed into just what – it's a good line. It's going to feed in to just what you were saying, that, you know, people are going to start looking at their own backyards. They're going to start looking to grow local as much as possible. And your things are going to change. And climate change, I think, is going to be a big part of that. It's a reason why we have to look for alternate sources and look closer to home to grow things.
Yeah.
And it tastes better.
Yeah.
it tastes a whole lot better. But, you know, with that being said, there's, like I said, there's so many people that have been asking us, you know, about this growing. They're so concerned. I wanted to – do you have – is there any words of wisdom that you can bestow upon some of our listeners about organic growing and getting out to do something on your own?
Well, I think the big key is to just be cautious of where you're buying your seed.
Mm-hmm.
Be careful of the fertilizers you use. Make sure that they're natural. Make sure that they're, you know, from a good source. And in New York City, I think just be careful of the soil that you're using too. I mean, we've had issues, and that we've been trying to address on soil quality and air quality in the city. They go hand in hand. So, you know, I think that's a big part of just being aware and reading labels and making sure that, you know, you're buying from trusted sources. And in New York City, Green Thumb is a really piece of government, if I might add that.
Yep.
And they're, you know, really good resource for helping people who are not just starting out, but who've been growing for years.
Right.
Big up to Nancy.
Nancy calling the new director.
New director of Greensboro.
And I've met Nancy, and you know we've been working hand in hand on a lot of different issues. She's a true ally. Very, very transparent, very, very concerned about New York City, New York City people. Definitely do not hesitate to get in touch with Green Thumb and Nancy Cone.
She's a keeper. The other one, Nancy's a keeper, though.
She's a real deal, right?
Yeah. She's a real deal. She's the truth like Holyfield. I like her. Like you said, she's transparent. She cares. You know, like I sit there.
Jeff, I love that you use Holyfield. I'm a huge boxing fan, so I know it doesn't work quite with my peace movement ideas, but I love boxing, and Holyfield's one of those guys. Yep.
But I have to say that out of all of the people, for Green Thumb, I would like to say that she really is. Like I said, she's transparent, but she, out of all of the people, she's accessible. You can call.
Yeah.
You can speak
That's
to
my
her.
Favorite part
you
about her.
You can get her.
Yeah.
That other director that was there, I forgot her name, but, everybody has a different style. That's what I say. That's
everybody
what
has a different style. Yeah.
You like
and
that,
that's
Aziza?
What it is.
You like that one? No, but everything's true. Everyone has a different style, and we have to humbly accept their styles.
Yeah.
I wanted to touch on what you said about organic. Organic, the new organic now is that the government is regulating, saying that organic could actually mean that pesticides are being used on it, but not as many pesticides as usual. Yeah. I know.
Yeah. Who do we thank for that? Well, that's why I said that's why I said with the organic piece, you have to know your sources. You really have to trust your sources.
Exactly.
And because you're right. I mean, it looks like now, every state has their own different level of what organic means. The feds have their regulations. And you just have to trust your own self. You have to make sure that what you're buying you believe to be the right thing. I mean, that's always been the case. I think now more than ever when like you're saying, they literally dilute the product and tell you it's one thing when they're using pesticides. That doesn't seem right.
Exactly. So then actually the definition of organic was changed to suit the agrochores and stuff like that. But that's another reason why this show was done, to expose and to get information out so that people could be more informed. The more you informed, the more information that you have readily available, the more knowledge you have and the more better decisions you can make.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the more you know, the better decisions. That you said it perfectly.
Yeah, but
we definitely thank you for coming on. You brought a lot of information out, and I wanted to say before you leave that we do commend Speaker Mark Roberto for supporting you guys and supporting the movement and being accessible and trying to bridge the gap and make it safe for all community gardens. I appreciate her assistance in that. Because even though I haven't been part of those discussions, it still, affects us all that are into it and take it seriously and really want to do the community outreach and continue to do it in peace.
I'll echo that. I mean, that's exactly true. And, just in closing, for all your listeners, come take a look at our website, nyccgc.org, and we need people out there. So when we go to the SCR and to have people in the room to represent themselves and represent the community, represent community gardens, that's really important. And we've talked a lot in this last half hour about how to move forward and how to move forward. I think we all agree is by sticking together and being at rallies and making sure that they know that we're watching them You know, mm-hmm. Nancy Cohn and the speaker, they're all great people, but they have to know that they represent us the people,
yeah.
And it's important to keep being out there and keep doing the right thing.
Right.
So we thank you, Aziza.
Thank
you. Have to go. This was Aziza Dekan, the Executive Director of the New York City Garden Coalition. We appreciate you coming out, and we thank you.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Anytime. I'll come on anytime. This was great. Thank you all.
Oh, all right. Take care, Aziza. Thank you so much.
Take care. Good night, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, Aziza's the man up here in New York. He's a humble servant, but, you know, he wields a big stick. So with that being said, I'm going to let Chef get into her piece.
Continuing on the discussion about gardening and the proliferation of it and the impact it's doing on communities all over the country, this was recently released by NaturalSolutionsMag.com. Gardening to date is the number one hobby in the United States, which I think is terrific, and it just makes all of our efforts in the green movement and whether it's the garden movement, the urban farming movement, the micro-local systems movement, they all are parallel, and they all bring out, I think, the best in people.
And it makes sense.
So this is the article. Gardening grows as millennials dig in. Number one hobby in America gets boosts from interest in locally grown food. Now, gardening is growing as the number one hobby in America, with roughly 5 million more households digging in and planting than in 2010. Driven by millennials' interest in edible gardening, according to the 2013 National Gardening Survey. The edible gardening category, which includes vegetable gardening, herb gardening, fruit trees, and growing berries, recently hit a 6-year high in both participation and spending. So not only are people taking it seriously, it's becoming more, not even a trend anymore.
It's feasible.
It's feasible, and it's becoming a lifestyle. And that's what us at Culinary Kids, as well as other nonprofit groups dealing with food and the environment. It's not just about activism. It's about a lifestyle. It's about introducing it to generations that didn't have as much access to locally grown organic food in a micro-local food system setting and making it as locally as possible where you can just go outside and go across the street and there's a garden there with a lot of fruits and vegetables that you can either purchase, or if they have their food banks, which is another growing trend. A lot of people are doing food banks within their gardens, such as Culinary Kids. You know,
there's another trend. So you know what this trend is? This is a trend that has been going on for a couple of years now. I've been seeing executive directors and people of that have non-profit organizations are actually on the ground in real time doing the things that need to be done as opposed to being in the office.
Right.
Perfect example, Aziza, Karen Washington, these people like these are on, they're in the forefront of the food revolution,
yeah.
And they are actually getting their hands dirty.
Right.
As opposed to sitting behind an office, sitting in an office behind a desk.
And looking at your computer.
You're looking at your computer and dictating some stuff and getting some stuff dictated to you or whatever the case is. Just they're in real time. The thing is, that's the new trend. This trend is about people really understanding. And what's so sad is that some people that have all these organizations,
mm-hmm.
they're not in the know at all about growing and things of that nature. And what they do know is a little bit.
Right.
And the thing is that this is something that if you're going to be a part of, you need to, everybody has a different learning curve, but you
right.
need to really be a part and you need to do your homework so that you can be able to grow some, you know, grow food and do the things that your organization does. So
we commend all of those.
We commend all of those that are doing it, and we also commend the people million-dollar CEOs that have the millions of dollars and can actually finance to get somebody else to do it. So, like, no, but it doesn't. It's good because of the simple fact they're still helping to feed people,
right,
no matter how they do it. So these bigger, big ups to all of the major organizations that are spending their bread and making sure that the
movement continues.
The movement continues
in the right way.
And people of that are less fortunate can eat, without question.
So in continuing to the article, looking to source locally grown food straight from their backyards, nearly 80% of gardeners aged 18 to 30 purchase vegetables to grow. According to the 2014 Home Garden Panel by Metrolina, greenhouse is the nation's largest greenhouse. Growing berries emerges as the most popular trend in edibles, likely due to the reported health benefits of foods like antioxidants-rich blueberries. In fact, blueberry consumption grew more than 500% from 1980 to 2010, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now, today, more than 25% of millennials consumers under the age of 24 purchase berries weekly or even more frequently. Blueberries are also the most popular food edible at Lowe's, with the varieties of O'Neill Misty Early Blue and Sunshine Blue generating the most interest from consumers. Lowe's offers container and landscaping planting options, as well as berry mixes of raspberry and blackberry. Now, regardless of age, gardeners grow edibles for the pride of harvesting their own fresh produce, to experience the growing process, and to share. Almost two-thirds report plans to share their harvest with family or neighbors, lending to the growing trend of community gardening. If it's still too cool to plant fruits and vegetables in your region, consider planting edibles, including the ever-popular blueberries, tomatoes, and cucumbers, in containers you can keep indoors until the weather warms. Now, perfect example. Out here in the Rockaways,
it's cold.
It's cold, cold, cold. And that's primarily because of the climatic environmental impact post-Sandy. And we anticipated that as a community that this would happen, and lo and behold,
it happened. It did happen.
And it's continuing to happen. Now, the weather reports for, like, the next 2 weeks is still staying in the mild 60s to the, 40 or even 35 degrees in the evening. So that's not normal for the Rockaways. And it's hard for community gardeners to grow. It's been, outdoors. Now, what we've done in the interim of being able to grow outdoors and make sheets,
Listen, I'm going to say this to you. We are in, even though Sandy happened, climate change is affecting the whole globe.
Yeah.
Now, with that being said, growing food on a massive scale, don't think it's happening like that. Not like it used to.
Right.
Maybe in, like, Central America and, I'm just saying, I don't know what's up with those opium crops and all of the cocaine crops, but they're going to have to really start growing food.
Yep.
And I'm saying to you that the closer you are to the equator, I hope the better you will be, but because of this climatic change in the weather,
right,
what's happening is local micro food systems will be, they're going to go up like McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? Like franchises without the franchise and without the money.
Right.
They are going to go up. They're going to pop up overnight. Like, what was that, Walgreens, remember? I know somebody understands and knows what I'm talking about. Have you ever went past the empty lot and then, like, a couple of days, it seems like maybe a couple of days later you came back and saw Walgreens like that?
I remember that.
Yeah, something, your Walgreens, I don't know, they construction crews are just
mystical.
Off the chain, because you go by one place and you don't see it, and then like a couple of days later, pop, just popped up,
mm-hmm.
Walgreens. So with these local micro food systems are going to pop up,
mm-hmm.
like chicken pox all across mm-hmm. the board. It's not going to be, that is going to be the thing.
Yep.
And not only is it going to be the thing, it is going to be our future.
Yeah.
Until we establish some type of really indoor environment, which there are indoor growing environments.
Yes.
And the thing is that there's going to be a lot of those popping up too. But I believe that the local microfood systems is something that is attainable.
Yeah.
Attainable to people in low economic communities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other ones, I don't think they're attainable to a large degree. So we have to focus and concentrate on a local system, locally grown in a I'm not going to even say a small setting, but the acreage, like how upstate New York,
yeah,
in California, places are suffering because of the climate.
So now the trend is growing indoors.
The trend is more so. It is growing. It's about growing indoors, but it's going to be to the point and to the fact where we're going to have ecological, biological systems in place.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, like, there's going to be a greenhouse, but these greenhouses are going to encompass. They're going to encamp the overall picture of a ecosystem, a system that is sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we are being pushed to and forced to. With genetically modified organisms in our food, GMOs are, they're here for a reason. And, I mean, if we're eating foods that could actually kill us, there's only three syllables I can say. There's only three words I can say. Chef Moses is going to always be like this till the day he dies. Three words. Population control. And that's it. I'm going to leave it alone. You want me to leave it alone? I'm going to leave it alone. But the thing is that you don't have to be have a PhD to put certain things together.
Right.
And, you know, of course, I'll use conspiracy theorists. Listen.
If the evidence
has web feet and it has a beak and it quacks like a duck and it looks like a duck, it's a duck. It's not a donkey. It's not anything else because I've seen the web feet. The metaphor is showing the information. The information
yep.
is out there. So the thing is that you have to put it together.
Mm-hmm.
You have to put it together.
Yep.
The only way you can put something together
is
information. The lack of information leads you to draw bad, wrong conclusions.
Yep.
But the more information you have, the better conclusions you can
obtain
obtain it without question.
But with that being said, regardless of age, I believe if it's still too cool to plant fruits and vegetables in your region, consider planting edibles, including the ever-popular blueberries, tomatoes, and cucumbers, in containers that you can keep indoors until weather warms. Once spring has sprung, take your pre-grown plants outside to add color and further accessorize your outdoor space with the extra benefit of harvesting fresh fruit straight from your backyard. For more information about planting inspirations and how-to advice, you can go on their website at youtube.com/Lowe's. So this is just amazing. I mean, gardening has always been here. It's just that people really don't have time to garden. But it's good to see that people are taking the time out to garden and to continue the momentum. And the whole thing is about sharing, whether it's through a farmer's market or a farmer's stand or a food pantry or
Got a joke for you. What do they call gardening in the ancient days?
What, Chef?
Growing food.
So it's more of a lifestyle, like how it should have been, like how it was in the ancient days. I mean, everybody, there was no such thing as McDonald's before in the BCs.
Right. And there was no such thing as weather modifying controls and machines that could control the weather.
Yeah.
It came hard. All of these things. And it wasn't a bad, they were not, the atmosphere was not contaminated
right.
as it was. The sun actually shined a lot brighter. But you have to remember, the sun will never see. The sun to us is really shining, really, really bright. But it's really not. Have you ever had those shades? Mm-hmm. Ever had those shades that, like, they look like yellow, and when you put them on, you can, like, see clear, like, really bright and clear? There's no hue. There's no cloud or misty. But see, since the Industrial Revolution in the United States has put all of that coal and all of these other chemicals that are in the air, believe it or not, we're getting a reflection of a gray haze of the sun. We're not really seeing the whole sun because it's like a small curtain, like a veil. It looks really crisp and clear, but thing is, again, you know, maybe someone can do this. Look this up for me. It's called argon. And actually, the Germans invented a machine back during, Hitler and the Reich and the Third Reich. They invented a machine using argon energy that actually was cleaning the static and cleaning the air. And, well, what happened over this technology? Where is it at? Oh, it existed back then, but it just doesn't exist, and nobody and their mama has been experimenting and doing research on this particular thing I'm talking about. Well, I'm pretty sure somebody was doing some research, and they have developed, but I'm pretty sure it's probably, you know, some military application or something like that, and it's nothing that is going to benefit the human race. Are you using it to benefit the human race? Then you're not. I'm be honest with you. As far as, you know, this, what was it? I was talking about, I don't want to go too far off the subject. I just, with this weather modification and all that stuff, mm-hmm. there's a lot of things that's going on.
There's a lot of stuff going on.
Simple, because of all of the carbon and stuff that is trapped in the air, we're getting a stream. We're getting like, the pollution is like a filter. And the sun is not really, the sun is shining and all that, but it would shine a lot better and we'd feel a lot hotter if all of the pollution wasn't in the air. Now, I don't want to sound crazy, but if the pollution's in the air and the sun is hitting you, with that pollution, is that pollution baking onto your skin? Are all of the chemicals that are in the air, are all of the, you know, I remember as a young man, and I'm older now, so I remember, look, I see now as an older man, you know, I can literally, if you stay still and look clear enough, you can see particles really floating in the air.
Mm-hmm.
As a child, I know myself. I didn't see stuff like that floating in the air like that. Even outside, you see it too. So like I said, things have changed, but I want to get back on dealing with back in New York.
Right.
During World War II, they were planning what they called Victory Gardens during World War II, they planted these Victory Gardens because there was a shortage. They were rationing out food mm-hmm. in the United States. But there's a lot of my people that are in the audience right now that have never, ever heard of what I just said. And what I'm about to tell you is even a little bit deeper. But community gardening in New York City is always followed the boom and bust cycle. Now check this out. Listen closely. It's followed the boom and bust cycles of the economy, with gardens sprouting up during periods of stress and falling land values, then withering away with demand on the land because it became overwhelming. During the Depression, right, the City Welfare Department and the Federal Workers Project, the administration, they sponsored nearly 5,000 relief gardens on vacant and city parks, including Tompkins Square. Now, there were thousands of neighborhood kids. These children were issued plots of land. They were 4x4. These plots only at the end of the harvest. But the WPA it canceled the relief project in 1937 when the USDA initiated its food stamps program for farm surplus produce. Now, check that out. The USDA, the initiative for food stamps, the program, was implemented because of farm surplus. So I guess the government got together, Congress and senators got together, and instead of letting all of that food rot, they had to come up with a way for people to be able to buy this food before it became spoiled. Someone said that was a waste. So that was why the food stamp, the USDA initiated its food stamp program. Now, again, this was in 1937. Through many immigrant families continued tending backyard plots, the gardening caused it remained dormant until World War II. Then the city announced that all available city-owned land would be cultivated for Victory Gardens. Despite their success, these plots were abandoned at the close of the war, when the end of food rationing and the Bargonian, the frozen food industry, they squabbled the initiatives of urban farmers. By contrast, the electric patchwork of more than 800 community gardens that have taken root in New York City since 1970 were born not out of governments, but rather its neglect during the fiscal crisis waves of arson and abandonment of the city. The arson that they're talking about is during the time of back in the 60s, civil rights movement, with Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, these men were killed, assassinated. That's why a lot of people are not even aware of the history. That is why that's why the South Bronx looked the way it looked.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people just don't even know the history behind why the South Bronx used to look the way it looked. And I am a product of, I was born and raised in the birthplace of hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I call the South Bronx, the birthplace of hip-hop. I was born and raised there. 763 Jennings Street, right off of one block off of Boston Road.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny that these little known facts are not even known, but I told, believe it or not, some grown-ups this about 15 years ago. I remember this. We was talking, and I was telling some grown-ups and some kids that, the reason why the South Bronx is like that because, of what I just said. And, they didn't, not only did they not believe me, they actually said I was crazy. So, like I said, certain information, that's the thing, too. Certain information, that's why you have to be very careful. Certain information seems scary and crazy to a lot of people, but mm-hmm. the thing is that information is really, you have to be able to decipher, mm-hmm. decipher through the information so that you can get a better view of what's being said and what's going on. But sometimes, believe it or not, certain things are so hard to believe, and then they really are really true to,
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, during the fiscal crisis of waves of arson and abandonment left the city scared with thousands of crumbling buildings and vacant rubble, these lots. So by 1977, there were more than 25,000 vacant lots in New York City. They were littered with trash, rats. Open source became, listen, I remember when it was in 1978, I remember there was a thing with rats. They had a very big problem with rats, and they were doing something about, they were putting, rat poisons in these yards, inside a lot of these vacant buildings. And I'm going to tell you something that I know for a fact personally, and I didn't hear it on the news, and I never saw it on the news either. Back in the days, young boys used to go, and, you know, these abandoned lots used to have mattresses. What the young boys used to do is get all of these mattresses and put them together, and they just flip on them. You know, that was the pastime. But now, because they had put a lot of that poison down there, there were some children in our neighborhood that died from ingestion of that rat poison in those vacant lots. And I never heard nothing about that on the news. Never, ever. And I remember that. I remember that because two of the young boys were one of my brother's friends. So I remember that the community at hand, what the community did was they spoke to the children and they forbidded the children from playing inside these abandoned lots. And the thing was that they were parents. It was a different era, man, because there were parents that actually would rotate and take turns in the parks. Boston Road, there's a couple of parks, especially Katona Park, used to take turns with the children, taking them to the park, watching the kids. This is where we used to be at as a community.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like that now. So we need to get back to that. We really truly do.
And we will. It's going to take time.
Yeah, but we will. They became magnets for drugs, prostitution, chop shops, and for stripping down stolen cars. Yet the city only responded was to spend thousands of dollars in closing the lots with cyclone fencing. You know what that is, right? Mm-hmm. It's the fencing with the barbed wire.
Oh, wow.
But fed up with the government in action, in 1973, an impassionate artist named Liz Christie and a band of like-minded activists called the Green Gorillas began taking over abandoned lots on Manhattan's Lower East Side.
Mm-hmm.
Armed with bolt cutters and pickaxes, they conceived themselves as a strike force to liberate the crumbling landscape around.
Mm-hmm.
They founded their first garden on the corner of Bowery and Hudson.
Wow.
Now, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Where a few months earlier, a couple of bums had been found frozen to death in a cardboard box. I remember that news. I remember that news article, too. You could have never picked a more likely place to start a garden.
Mm-hmm.
This is Bill Bronson. He was an early Green Gorilla at the time.
Right.
At the time, there was still all of these men lined up along the Bowery drinking wine and panning. To put a garden there in what was probably the ultimate slime spot in the city. Now, this is, you know, of course, this is, I wouldn't say slime spot, but, you know, it's a spot where there's drunken people at. And they're drinking wine and panning. So. So the spot where the wine drinkers and the panhandlers were, it was a sticky spot.
Mm-hmm.
It was also in the eyes of bureaucracy illegal. At first, the city accused the group of trespassing and threatened to boot them off the land.
Mm-hmm.
But after a media blitz, when the gorillas brought in TV cameras to show how they transformed the lot, creating soil with nothing but sifted rubble and compost, the city backed down and offered them a lease in 1974.
Wow.
So now, what you're reading, what I am telling you about, what you're hearing is actually one of the many stories of how of the urban farm movement and this, that, and the other. But you have to remember, there's people like Liz Christie and Green Gorillas, but there are so many others. That's why the history is so rich and diverse. And, you know, to make a long story short, I think a lot of the gardening and farming came with immigration.
Mm-hmm.
like before immigration. I mean, before the immigrants came over, I think what happened was the first farms was actually, you know, doing slavery and stuff like that. But I think what happened was the immigrants brought a taste of their culture to America. And with that, there were other, you know, subtle nuances.
Mm-hmm.
But I think with the arrival and emergence of the immigrants, like I said, they brought a lot of different seeds from their countries.
Right.
And now
a lot of heirloom seeds
are here in the United States to a large degree.
Mm-hmm.
Degree because,
and personal seed bank.
Right. And because of the immigrants coming over to this country. So, you know, with that being said, it is something the Green Gorillas are aspiring. We've worked with them. We have actually
We built our first compost. We built
Green Gorillas, our first urban farm. Green Gorillas came out and
with other partners,
Botanical Gardens, Green Gorillas,
Olympus Garden Club.
Big up to Salida. Hey baby. And so many other But the thing is that the Green Gorillas have been doing what they have been doing for a long time, just like a lot of other organizations. We're going to have other stories talking about the history, because the history is really long and rich, and it's a lot of it's not just one group, or it's a culmination of a whole lot of groups. And, you know, believe it or not, I did, and you know what, I'm going to try to go back and post, get some of these pictures and try to post them on the, on maybe on Facebook or our website. I did the Van der Zee's. I don't know if you, Mr. Van der Zee was the movement of the early Renaissance in Harlem. He took a lot of the,
mm-hmm.
all of the black and white pictures and stills that you see pertaining to Harlem was done by Van der Zee himself.
Mm-hmm.
His granddaughter, and I know the family very well too. They have a gallery. It's called the S.E. May Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in Harlem.
Mm-hmm. Still there.
It's still there. It's in a private mansion, but, like I said, there are some pictures of early black farms, and Van der Zee has some of Mr. Van der Zee's photos were never, all of his photos were never really publicized. Some of his stuff was publicized, and other things.
Not his whole collection.
Yeah, not his whole collection. So there are pictures of black. Yeah, there's pictures of black farmers, people in the neighborhood. It used to be row houses in Harlem, and
mm-hmm.
in the back of these row houses, there are gardens and
mm-hmm.
all that. So, you know, it's a combination of so many people
putting their foot down
and growing. And the thing is, everybody grows, you know, our cultures, everybody grows, everyone has to eat. So by introducing seeds and bringing seeds from down south and bringing seeds from Puerto Rico and bringing seeds from the Dominican Republic, you know, Yugoslavia, Ukraine, all of these places, Poland, all of these places, people in
Czech Republic, all that.
They brought from all over the world, they brought seeds here to the United States. And they did that in hopes to make a better life for themselves
mm-hmm. and, be able
and
to
their
grow.
Family and to be able to grow through what they did in their country. So, I guess we're going to have some more discussions and topics dealing with this show is going to be one of many pertaining to this thing, because this is some rich history that has to get out though.
Yeah,
like I told you, that name is Van der Zee, and if I was you, I would go to the SCA galleries down in
Harlem.
That's Convent Avenue.
I believe so.
I don't know Convent, but
mm-hmm.
What I'll do is get some of the information for you for some of our listeners. If you're interested, you can contact us.
Let me let, well, we're going to be taking a break. For more information on the SMA galleries and the New York Garden Coalition, or any of the topics that we've discussed over our 3-month period, or anything about Culinary Kids, you can reach us at culinarykidscsa@yahoo.com. That's culinarykidscsa@yahoo.com. For more information about Culinary Kids overall, you can check out our website at www.culinarykidsdaycamp.org. That's culinarykidsdaycamp.org. To donate, you can definitely go to www.culinarykidsdaycamp.org/donate.
Can you say that again? I didn't hear.
www.culinarykidsdaycamp.org/donate. Our Facebook name.
Growing season.
Definitely. Our Facebook page is Culinary Kids Day Camp. Twitter is @culinary_kids. Plug, plug, plug. You can visit our Farm Rockaway store at www.cafepress.com/farmrockaway.
Check out those tilapia flip-flops, baby.
We get a lot of smiles on those. But nevertheless, we're about to take a break, and we'll be back in a few.
We'll be back.
Sexy. Okay, yes. I'm gonna get with you. Hey, yeah.
Don't wanna sound full of myself or rude, but you ain't looking at no other dude, 'cause you love me.
I'm sorry, baby.
So you think about a chance, you find yourself trying to do my dance, maybe 'cause you love me.
You do well.
So then we tried.
Taking it slow now because you weren't used to how fast we touched.
We touched.
Then we locked eyes.
And I knew I wasn't there and I was gonna tear your ass up.
Yeah,
I know that I'm carrying on. Never mind if I'm showing off. I was just frozen.
You know.
Tell her you gon' call her ass how it was, and she's gon' love it. Whoa, whoa,
yeah,
yeah. So then we tried.
Taking it slow now because you weren't used to how fast we touched.
We touched.
Then we locked eyes.
And I knew I wasn't there, and I was gon' tear your ass up.
Yeah,
I know that I'm carrying on. Never mind if I'm sure.
Up, I would act all nonchalant in front of an audience like you was just another shorty. I put the naughty on, but truth be told, you threw me for a loop this hole. I'm too old to be frontin' when I'm feeling, then selling, acting like you ain't appealing when you are, spelling like you ain't my only girl when you are. I'm ready to stop when you are.
Like this real. Thank you, baby.
then what's gonna hurt you to be from love? When you get hurt by the one you're living by, pain can make you wanna love no more.
No more. I just can't be loving you no more. I love you more than I love myself.
Recalls Amos Teller. another early Green Gorilla member, he was quoted as saying, "As we were basically saying to the government, if you won't do it, we will."
Amazing.
So by 1976, their efforts were beginning to win over government officials, including a little-known Brooklyn congressman named Fred Richmond, who pushed through a federal program to support urban gardening in Brooklyn. The first demonstration project was set up through the Cornell University Cooperative Extension Services. It was so successful that a national program was funded at a $3 million expansion to include 15 other cities.
Amazing.
Now check this out. Appalled by the devastation he witnessed during his historic walk through the burnt-out section of the South Bronx, and I remember that, in 1977, Carter pledged $500,000, half a million dollars.
Which was a lot of money back then.
Back then, that was, for new parks and recreation facilities. That was part of the $10 million proposal for immediate aid to the area. And that was in 77. It took a long time for the stuff. I wonder what happened to that money. Let me stop. It took a long time for the South Bronx to reach the what it looks like now. You'd be surprised if you see what the South Bronx looked like compared to if you remember what it looked like before that.
It's like night and day.
Yeah, totally. The proposal actually eventually led to the allocation of $1.2 million in federal and New York State funds for community gardens and parks development in the South Bronx. Now, the grant required a 50% match of local funds money, what city government could ill afford. So in one of the first official recognitions of the value of sweat equality, right? It's, well, sweat equity. Gardeners filled up their volunteer hours, as well as their bricks, beams, and fallen telephone poles. They recycled from their devastating community and even composted they generated in order to come up with $300,000.
Wow.
The city made up the remaining $900,000 through street trees and sidewalk improvements.
Amazing.
Now, that's a testament to the tenacity of when people got something in their mind, they're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Just let's not build no towers of battle no more. But, I mean, we can get together and do some things that's going to improve and help the community without question. So the gardens became catalysts for community development. Once people succeeded with the garden, they went on to other things like fixing the schools, housing, creating jobs, whatever was needed. So now that's how it starts. It starts with one thing. It's not necessarily in the order that I read it.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily have to start with a garden.
Right.
Usually it starts with
a thought.
It does start with a thought, but yeah. Usually it's something that needs to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
So there were people in their minds talking about, well, we need to get new schools, and we need to get better housing, and we need to get jobs. So it's always been a melee, so to speak. But the thing is that once you as a community come together to involve yourself in a project that is community-based, the longevity and the whole thing is supposed to be for future generations. This is something that invokes priorities when you're talking about children in the future. So some of the community groups that emerged through the early greening schematics including the Bronx Frontier Development Corp, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and the People's Development Corp. On the Lower East Side, gardeners grew in tandem with the Bargonian homesteading movement in the early 70s. Can we say draconian? Before the civil rights activists from the South named Sarah Furley formed a group called LAND, Local Action for Neighborhood Development, aims to create self-help housing in open space. Sarah said, actually, do the gardens first, then the buildings, recalls Emmett Boyle, who helped founded the 6th and B Garden in 1981, as well as a series of squatter homesteads on East 13th Street, five of which were evicted in 1995 and 1996. The gardens were a natural screening process for those who could be good homesteaders, said Boyle. We figured anyone nutty enough to climb over a fence and start crawling away at the dirt with a hammer would be a good squatter. Yeah, I think so.
I agree.
Yeah, anybody that's willing to do that? Yeah. But guess what? All of us could be put in a situation where we say we wouldn't be, I wouldn't do that. But
boy, when it comes down
when
to
it. When it comes down to it, you get the opportunity. Meaning like, say you couldn't get no food, I bet you'd be out there digging with a hammer if you didn't have no hoe. You know, I'm just saying.
You'd find a way.
A hoe or a shovel or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, you'd find a way. It's funny, food and water, a change of thoughts real quick. Real talk. Actually, for many of these, the gardens were also attracting more active-minded people in the neighborhood who appreciated the social fabric that these gardens provided. You know, a garden is like the quintessential barbershop, so to speak, to a I'm not going to even do that because, you know, in the garden, anything is up for grabs to talk about, but usually, you know, everybody's really kind of, certain gardens are like that, so certain gardens are like the proverbial barbershop, you know, but it's a place where we can meet, the barbershops is a place where we can meet, you know, without question, but we've had to get up and we've had to say, well, listen, that's not the only place where we're at. You know, and I think what happened was that the barbershop was the training grounds to be able to talk about anything. And there's a lot of people that understand and know what I'm talking about because things that's talked about in the barbershop is just not talked about everywhere. So in gardens, they became the social fabric. People loved the social fabric that the garden provided, whether it was a Shinto garden or Japanese tea house in the garden or this, you know, these are conversation pieces. These are things that can be, you know, discussed and talked about. I think, like I said, it's very important that gardens, green spaces are here. It's a beautiful thing that they're here and we have to start to utilize them more. There's a whole lot of new gardens popping up all over the place to a large degree. And like I said, people need to start getting out in their communities and finding out where some of these hidden oases are, these jewels that are in our community. So back to what I'm saying, for many of these activists, gardens were seen as part of an overall strategy of urban self-sufficiency. You know, in addition to cleaning up empty lots for gardeners, the East 11th Street Movement topped one of their homesteads with a solar greenhouse and the nation's first rooftop windmill generator. They also installed a 300-gallon fish farm in the basement of another squat shop with hundreds of tilapia, African fresh water fish. While the fish farm and the windmill were short-lived, the garden they started on East 12th Street went on to become El Sobrillo, which incorporated as a land trust in 1978 and is now run by members of the East 12th Street Block Association.
A lot of history.
A lot of history, but like I said, we're going to have a couple of more shows on this because there are a lot of groups, organizations, and individuals that need to get out there and be to get out this information. I'm going to say this, and I'm going to turn it over to Chef Rivera. parks, we have to thank everything that we're dealing with right now, I think, is coming to fruition because of there's a lot of things that's happening in the world today. So, you know, these are things that are going to be talked about and discussed on a bigger scale and a bigger magnitude. But I think, I'm being sarcastic what I'm about to say right now. I think what we have to do is thank Robin Moses for all of the things that we're dealing with right now. But I say this, though, if it wasn't for some of his train of thought and his thinking,
we wouldn't be here talking about it.
You know, I'm going to say this to you. My mother, my father and mother always used to say that you have to experience the bad stuff first in order to recognize the good things. So, like I said, I'd like to thank Robert Moses for his initial mark that he left, because by thanking him, and you know what, now I'm not being sarcastic, but by thanking him now, we are saying that the old ways are dead, and there's new ways and there's new blood, and, you know, we can get things done.
Right.
So, again, thanks, Robert Moses, for what you've done to make us realize that we need to be more sustainable.
Well, I mean, somebody had to start the trend, right? Now, this is an article from treehugger.com, and it adds on to, you know, I mean, we can't touch on all of the history in 2 hours, but we could definitely
bombard you with what we got.
Yeah. So this article was dated July 27, 2010, and speaking on protected status, New York's community garden lose protected status, threatened with development under new rules. Now, I went to the hearing in 2011 on this topic.
It was bugging out.
And
bugging out.
Every garden that was in New York City, every nonprofit organization you could think of, dealing with the food movement period, whether it's the community garden aspect, whether it's the agricultural aspect, whether it's the food movement aspect, whether it's policy and procedures of the food movement, everybody was there putting their comments and concerns on record. And it was a life-changing experience for me. I submitted some words from our perspective as an organization to the hearing. It was an all-day thing. It was long, it was intensive, but it was a very good experience as far as the land usage situation in New York City.
New York City. How about the block of priorities on this side?
No, you know, I mean, politics, it's just unfortunate that politics overall intertwines in a way sometimes that's not conducive. And, you know, I hope that changes. It was good to find out that the Speaker of the House, Speaker Mark Roberto, was very interested in, you know, it's good to hear that she's, you know, supporting the movement. And, you know, but nevertheless, it's just so much stuff people had to go through to get to where they needed to get with the food movement. And, you know, granted that, you know, during the hearings and after the hearings that there was more protection allocated to community gardens. But, you know, situations with the boardwalk garden and other projects that have been affected by politics and money, you know, I hope that there's some kind of common ground. I hope that, you know, people can work together as opposed to not working together.
Yeah, you know what, you're right. But you know what, though? See, the thing is that there's a lot of people that have no foresight.
That's
what
true.
They want to do is do foolish things.
Yeah.
And the thing is,
contradictory things.
You have to be vigilant, ever so vigilant. You really, truly must. Because there's a lot of stuff that's going on in our world,
mm-hmm.
and nobody's really paying attention. You know why? Because everybody's paying attention to Dancing with the Stars and all of this other mind cloud, Jedi mind trick stuff. The thing is that the real world, oh, you know what, I'm sorry. I just don't watch Dancing with the Stars, but I do, you know, watch some, you know, I watch movies. I don't watch TV. I watch movies.
Right.
Stuff that's educational and all that. That's what I watch. That's what I deal with. But what's so sad is that we have been leveled to a society that we need to stop with that, man. Everything, theoretically, I could get an elephant to balance on the tip of a number two pencil. Theoretically, anything is possible.
Should that be debated?
But should that be debated? Do we want an elephant on a number two pencil?
Will that make sense?
What can we get from that? Listen, I'm just saying, theoretically, anything is possible, but we don't have to debate everything.
Right.
If you're polluting the air with coal, stop doing the shit. That's it. But you can't, because, you know, there's so many people, stakeholders, that have an investment in.
The community is the biggest stakeholder.
The community the biggest stakeholder. You know, I was reading somewhere. See, I'm getting off the subject. I was reading somewhere where, this was a long time ago. I was a young man. And if I'm not mistaken, Napoleon said that religion was made up to protect the wealthy. That's deep, man. That's deep. That's a deep statement, man. But I said that for a reason. Somebody go pick it up. But listen, it's deep with what we're all dealing with, but everything is, it really doesn't have to be debated. If you are spraying pesticides on some fruits and vegetables, man, and this shit is killing people, man, stop. And of course, I don't believe that. That's not happening. They wouldn't do that. But they're doing it. They're doing it, man. What are you talking about? This is what's going on. This is what's happening. But now, do we need to debate it? Do we need to say, well, listen, you know, it has its good points. There's no good points to it. If you are eating fruits and vegetables that's saturated with herbicides and pesticides, you're going to die. There's no argument. There's no debating. Oh, well, you know, I had a good run. That's it. You're dead. So the thing is that we have to stop with that. Society has taught us that everything is debatable, and we're just so wicked as people sometimes. All we like to do is just challenge, debate. And it doesn't, you might think you had won the debate, but the thing is that, you know, you won the debate by saying, oh, poisons are, you debated so well, you convinced everybody that poisons are a necessity because you're such a good debater. But the thing is that poisons are not a necessity, and you need to stop with that shit. There's no such thing as a good poison. Poisons are what it is. That's why they call it poison.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it has the skull and bones across it, because it's poison. They identify it. So, like I said, we have become the masters of deceit, man.
Yeah,
America, we've become the masters of deceit and destruction, of debating and all of that. I'm going to turn it back over to Chef Rivera.
Yeah, so.
I'm through. I digress.
Where can we go from here?
That's a song. You remember that song?
Yeah.
But it's true, though. It's true, Chef.
Where do we go from here? What is the agenda? Is that going to be about money? Or is there a dire need to change people's diet to ensure that they have longevity in life and to, you know,
I got a plan.
Where do you go?
Let's try listening to this plan for a second, since I got the ear. Listen, here's the plan.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody stop bullshitting and lying, right?
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. That's part of the plan. Everybody stop that, right? And stop being greedy and gluttonous, right? Right?
Yes.
And, oh, my God, think about the American public. Mm-hmm. What do you think? You think that's doable, Chef?
I think so, but it's just
because
of war.
I know. I think that, yo, you know what? I was just, check this out. I was just in Officer Campbell's, I was in his room today. I was in the police. I was in the police police station's room today. I was speaking with a gentleman, Officer Campbell. Officer Campbell has this button, right? I just have to listen around here. He has this button, and it's like a gray housing and a red button on top, and it says, and it reads bullshit. And I was like, wow. And I pressed it, and it said, I pressed the button, and the light went on and said, wow, the bullshit meter just went up. He said, bullshit, 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 all over. And I found that to be so funny. But he said his wife gave it to him. She gave it to him because he said he hears so much bullshit in and out the police precinct. That's why he got the bullshit button. So, you know, and he said something else. Let's say this. No, this is me saying it. I'm not going to say what he said, but I'm going to say this. This is what the politicians is their biggest problem. The bullshit. Mm-hmm. The lying. You know, you can say, you know, I'm so tired of this. I'm so sick of people being, oh, that's offensive, and, oh, that offended me. You know, you're saying bullshit. Man, cover your ears, man. Cover your ears. There's other things that are going on in the world that are more critical than a person screaming and saying something about bullshit. But this is what the politicians are doing, and they've been doing. Manipulation. Mm-hmm. Bullshitting. Bullshit artists. Mm-hmm. If they could stop the bullshit, oh, my God. Can you imagine what this country would be like?
Mm-hmm.
If all of the politicians stopped the bullshit,
mm-hmm.
we would really be, you know, we'd be like Japan, man.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have everybody would have computers and laptops and all of that. Because even in Japanese society, there are people that are considered, that they would be considered like serfs. But, I mean, even the serfs got an education.
Mm-hmm.
That means the lowest person in their society that they deem unworthy
was educated.
So, I mean, like my daddy said, the stomach was made for food, good food. The brain was made for good wisdom, knowledge, and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
If you give the stomach bad food, you'll get sick. If you give the brain wrong information and information that's not the truth,
mm-hmm.
and you're trying to sway people to believe a certain thing and it's not really true, what you're doing is feeding the brain bad information. And that bad food, it has a reaction, just like the bad food that goes into your stomach that poisons your body. You vomit, you throw up, you regurgitate your food. You throw it back up. So what do you think the brain does with the bad information? Well, if you don't know, I'm going to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you and it makes your children act foolish.
Mm-hmm.
Makes you do things. And, you know, sometimes I would like to say Tourette's, because it makes you say stuff that you just normally wouldn't do and say if you had a little bit of common sense and some real good education aside. So, you know, with that being said, I'm going to turn this over to the chef.
So I'm going to read a couple of excerpts from the article. I like how you said that. Thank you.
Excellent. Say it again.
Excerpts.
Hard-shuttered.
from the treehugger.com article back in 2010 about the hearings, which, like I said, I testified and thousands of others testified on behalf of the community garden movement. Gardens are amazing spaces to educate students about the environment, environmental research, planting, sustainable agriculture, and urban farming, as well as positive forms of community development and democracy renewal. In the midst of a fiscal crisis, the city could only dream of having such unique spaces, which help the city so much yet cost so little. Gardens help stabilize communities and reduce crime. There are places where people from all walks of life come together. There are places of education about the environment and the city, as well as world ecology. They are precious public spaces which should not be privatized. Community gardening is a way to fight the systematic injustice of poverty and other forms of structural oppression. Most of the gardens are in poor areas of the city, with much higher rates of asthma and lower rates of open space equity. From an indigenous community perspective, offer a way for our community to heal itself and to recover a humanizing sense of itself, its dignity in an otherwise very hard city. Now, through some areas with a high density of community gardens have gentrified significantly, unfortunately, pushing aside the poorest people who previously lived there.
Gentrification, a.k.a.
So,
get out, stay out.
You know, so, you know, it was a big whole thing with the community garden, privatization of the community gardens and the battle. Of it, but there's still the fight continues.
Because, you know what, you're right.
It's about money and politics, even with community gardening.
You're right, Chef, but you know what, though? I'm starting to see that with all of this stuff that's going on and being said, the ball is still in the government's court. And the ball, what it seems like to me is that the government is going to use other organizations that are with them to be, because they're like, people like, oh, the government is too much. You need to give, they're going to use the CBOs as a front to,
how can I say the status quo?
Yeah, but in a way that people, so a lot of people, what they're going to do is be like, you know, Phil Jackson. Phil Jackson is back in New York. I'm pretty sure, you know, even though Nick's got a coach and all that, I'm pretty sure Phil going to throw his little plays in and all of that. Maybe that was a bad example, but let's say this. There are forces and powers that if they can't manipulate, they use other people to manipulate. They use other organizations to get their message across. So now all you're doing is taking the bureaucracy out of the government's hands and dumping it into these big CBOs that are just as bad and that have their own agendas. Now, don't get me wrong. I can't speak for all of these organizations, but I can speak for a lot of them.
We understand the trend, though.
And we understand the trend, and we see, and we're forecasting the facts right about now. That's what we're doing. We're forecasting the facts, so you know, don't be alarmed. You know, like Christ said in the scriptures, he said, "Don't be amazed at the signs in heaven." You know, when you see blood moons and all this, you ain't supposed to be amazed at that because he said it was going to happen. So don't be amazed at it. Just know that it's going to happen, and don't be amazed because you were told, you were forewarned. So the thing is, again, that you have to have enough insight. It's simple. You know, if I touch that fire, will I get burned? You won't get burned. Don't touch the fire.
You got to see it for themselves.
Some people have to
know
for themselves.
Inevitable.
And they know the inevitable. So you have to know that move by move, the closer that you get to the stove, you're making a move, but the decision is to touch that fire. So you have to know the outcome of touching that fire. So that's just with anything in life that you do.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know, if you're going to step here and do this, you have to understand or think ahead far enough to say, well, what's going to happen? What could be the outcome if I do this? And we as humans, we have a tendency not to think about that shit all the time. We really, truly don't. That's why there's a lot of people that are incarcerated in jail right now because they did not stop to think. But guess what? Guess what? Some of them got 25, 30 years, and guess what? They got 25, 30 years I think about
everything, every day
that put that pivotal moment in their life. I should have did this. I should have did that. I should have did. Yeah, that's what you should have did, but you didn't. So, now, the thing is to learn how to
adjust
to readjust. But also, you have to be able to start to think in a sense of 25, 50, 100 moves ahead. Always have to. My father always said that. My daddy always said that. Always have to think. He said, And he said, if some people tell you it's a chess game, he said, it's a lie. He said, because even in a chess game, you can't think 100 moves ahead. He said, but in life, you got to think like that. So, Marion Moses, Doris Moses, I love you for everything that you've given. Without Christ, his father, and you be nothing. Chef Moses would be nothing. And it's because of my love for my father and my mother that have allowed me to do what I do to this day. My father did the same thing. My father and my mother, they fed and they helped people in their
communities. They helped their communities. That's
so
until this day,
married, going strong, August 31st of being their anniversary. I'm not going to tell you how many years because you wouldn't even believe it. So, with that being said, country food makes you live longer. Fruits and vegetables, healthy fruits and vegetables. You know, Mary Moses still grows his tomatoes. He has this thing about his topsy-turvy, though. He loves this topsy-turvy thing. Wow. But my mother's getting kind of sick. My mother was sick of it because the vines were all in the growing all over the place. Daddy's he's a rigger, man. My father's like MacGyver. He takes mirrors, uses the mirrors to bounce the sunlight inside the house to the man. Listen, this cat is just the innovation right there. But everything I owe everything that I am today to my father.
That's beautiful.
And I'm sorry, I got a newcomer now. I got somebody on the gravy train with me now. So I have to big her up too. You know, without her, my life would be meaningless. No, sorry. That's true, though. That's true.
Thank you, dear.
Okay. I'm good?
Yeah, you good?
Yeah?
Great.
All right, so okay, we'll talk about that. All right, you.
But, you know, I mean, we thank Aziza Dekan, who's the executive director of the New York City Garden Coalition.
Executive director, and he's so down to earth.
Yep.
He gets out there and makes it happen.
Yep.
What?
Yep. But he's always in the trenches, Karen Washington and the rest of the executive board. We thank you so much for the years of hard work, trying your damnedest to make sure that these community gardens stay alive and thrive, despite the status quo, despite political, financial gain. You guys have been in the forefront. We'd like to thank Green Gorillas for proliferating the way they did.
Being an instrument of the time.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to thank
Green Thumb.
Nancy, go in.
Nancy Cohen and Green Thumb staff for doing all the hard work that you guys do, to make sure that, community gardens get what they need, and it's greatly appreciated.
A special shout out to DC Black. Yes, indeed. Yes, sir. Yeah, we love you over here.
Yeah, we're going to end the show. Next week's topic will be food additives, shame on us. We're going to do a two-hour show on food additives and the fight over the United States, man. I don't know. It's the FDA, I mean, amazing. I understand that. It's just, food additives and the fight over food additives. Most of the other countries.
They don't even use, they're not using GMOs, they're not
they
using,
banned,
yeah, they banned it.
But
it's a
back and forth. I mean, it's just common sense.
But
additives are not good.
It's because the United States people, the people are not informed because they're
dancing
with the stars, Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah. And then you're ingesting these things and then you wonder, like, you start to get sick.
Hey,
illnesses that occur. I mean, it's incredible.
Didn't they say something about, we're going to be talking about it next week, but didn't they say something about that the coloring and the food additives are actually what's giving rise to ADHD and all this?
Yeah, ADHD and autism.
And they're finding this stuff out. But I'm telling you, this is something that just wasn't found out now.
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't just filed out now. The thing is that it's been this way, but the thing is, like my daddy used to say, he said, listen, there's always going to be a need for bus drivers, sanitation workers, and movie theater ushers. And I just never understood what, I mean, at the time, as a child, I didn't understand what he was saying. But, you know, some people have a set spot and place for us. And the thing is that we have to rise above that.
Mm-hmm.
The perfect example is Tuskegee.
Mm-hmm.
It was told, it was a military report that was written and said that black men couldn't fly airplanes. It was just, it was too much for a black man's brain. He just couldn't do it. So like I said, the thing is that we have to be able to understand.
Mm-hmm.
And listen to this. Check this out. This is to my peoples. You have to understand. Do not be emotional
mm-hmm.
over things.
Mm-hmm.
Do not allow people to make you emotional over things. Sometimes, you know, there's a time and a season and a place for everything. But you have to learn how to speak and communicate with people so that you can get your point across and express what's on your mind. That's what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be giving workshops like that in the summertime. You
like
know,
we
so.
Said, I mean, it's been difficult this year to go outdoors, but we are going indoors, and we, you know, periodically put stuff on Instagram and Facebook about, you know, what we've been doing thus far. But we will go back to programming, cross fingers and toes, next month. But the weather pattern is just so cold, and no one's really growing out here. I mean, there are maybe there's community gardens maybe doing little tulips, little toilets, little lettuce and stuff like that. But the hardcore tomatoes and stuff like cucumbers and
we doing that. We're doing that
indoors, but nobody's growing how you're supposed to grow in Zone 7 out here right now.
So actually, we're in between Zone 6 and Zone 7.
Yeah.
So, but usually we're usually the first in New York City to get the hot spell.
Yeah.
Because we get a southern climate that sweeps from the water
mm-hmm.
and then goes upstate, comes into Far Rockaway, goes to Brooklyn, Manhattan, Bronx, Mount Vernon, all that until it goes upstate, completely upstate. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, usually, again, like I said, we catch the season, the warmer part of the season first, and then the farmers that are upstate New York, they catch it later in the season. So their growing season is a little bit less than ours. But with that being said, I'm Chef Moses.
I'm Chef Rivera.
And we're going to talk with you next Thursday on our
13th show.
On our 13th show. And actually the 13th show, 13 is a very good number.
It's a lucky number.
It's a very lucky number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since Friday the 13th came out, nobody wants to even deal with the 13th to a large degree. But 13 really is a beautiful number.
So that is going to be a good show. So it's Green Talk Live and More, Culinary Kids, Culinary Arts Initiatives, copyright 2014, all rights reserved.
Hey,
I got to see you next.
Wait. I got to do this. I got to shout out team, the For Life team. Got to shout out the For Life team. Smarty Artie, yes, sir. Raymond Gonzalez, Rocky, Ray Chu, hey.
Rocky Rose.
And Brother Cheney and his wife. So, my partners for life, and
you can check us out on our email for life products, and to get involved too at culinarykidscsa@yahoo.com.
Hey, listen, for life is Christ is Father, for life is the move. We'll holler at you.
Thank you for tuning into Green Talk Live and More with Chef Moses and Chef Rivera on It's Real Talk Radio. You can catch the chefs on Facebook at Culinary Kids Day Camp, on Twitter at Culinary_Kids, or on their official website, culinarykidsdaycamp.org. Listen to Green Talk Live and More every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time by dialing 347